Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Betsy Whaley is Executive Vice President of MESED, the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, based in Berea. She joins us along with Dan Click, Director and Gallery Coordinator of the Grayson Gallery and Arts Center. They're here to talk to us about an initiative called What's Next Eastern Kentucky, or EKY. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Betsy, first, what is What's Next EKY?
What's Next EKY is a network of community partners and regional partners who are working together to lift up the stories of what's happening in Eastern Kentucky, to create a mutual learning network, and to try to work together and collaborate on regional initiatives.
Okay, and I understand that you just recently finalized a partnership agreement with member organizations. Besides your own, MESED, who else has signed on?
Well, on the steering committee, we have the Grayson Gallery and Arts Center. Dan, you can help me here, so
okay.
Jump in.
All right.
The Office of the Mayor in Prestonsburg, Kentucky is on the steering committee. The Olive Hill Council for Planning and Restoration, the Letcher County Culture Hub in Whitesburg.
And
I think that's all for the steering committee. And then regional partners, we have MESED, Apple Shop, the Brushy Fork Institute at Berea College, the Air Institute at Berea College, CEDIC, K-CARD, and the Foundation for Appalachia Kentucky, and Community Farm Alliance.
That's a pretty solid roster you have there.
Yep.
Dan, what attracted you to this?
Well, I've been involved in community for a long time, and this was one of the first concentrated efforts I'd seen that was towards a common goal to just bring everybody together. So having volunteered for years, it was just kind of nice to see some direction to all this.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about a recent survey that was taken among people in the region. What was the aim?
Well, over the last 2 years, this group has been working together to really figure out how we can work together and what are the common assets in the region that we could grow and what are the common challenges. And so we thought we had a pretty good idea of that because, you know, this is a bottom-up network, which means we really are working at the community level. We're not coming in with top-down initiatives. And so we have community members on the steering committee. We thought we think we know what it is, but we want to test our assumptions. So we sent out a survey asking people to respond to talk about what are the good things in their community, what would they like to see, what are the barriers that inhibit growth. And, you know, the good news is we pretty much confirmed what we already thought.
Well, that's interesting. Maybe each of you want to answer this question, but I'm curious, what did you find? What were the responses?
Oh, in a lot of ways, they weren't too surprising. It was mostly the same things. People were trying to really realize what they had to focus on initially at their own level, you know, their own communities. But then the answers about most things that people felt they wanted or needed were also pretty consistently the same. And we'd come in with those assumptions, but once you see it on paper and maybe some little fine points, the rest of it just seemed to make sense.
Yeah.
With what we'd already done.
And some of the things we saw in the survey were that people are very aware of and proud of their place and the beautiful geography of Eastern Kentucky and the cultural assets. People celebrate the community that they find in their local place and feel like that's a real strength of Eastern Kentucky. You know, on the other hand, they would like to see more diversity, a more diverse economy, more diversity within leadership. Almost universally, people are concerned about the opioid epidemic and what that means for families and, you know, grandparents raising grandchildren. They're worried about extraction and, you know, not wanting to recreate a mono economy that is extractive.
In interview after interview that we have here on Eastern Standard with people from a variety of walks of Eastern Kentucky life, we hear the same refrain put one way or another. and that is that it's time to stop waiting for answers and for help from outside the region and to start looking for ideas and solutions within our communities. Do you want to add your voices to that point of view?
I do. I think so much of it has already been going on. There's just not been a lot of awareness. And so that same voice that's had these problems or these desires or their accomplishments had all come together to realize that it was very common, much more common than I think each individual community realized. Once you started seeing everyone together, and along with our long list of bullet points, almost everyone could meet each one of those as well. So it was just something more common than expected.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Dan has a great story of doing exactly what you just said, you know, starting, not waiting for somebody else. You know, we've heard that a lot. You know, we've waited for somebody else to save us. We have to save ourselves. And, you know, we have to build on what we have. And, you know, the Grayson Gallery is a great example of doing just that.
I know that your survey found a lot of people believing tourism is the future of Eastern Kentucky. It's a big, it's a very diverse region, with no shortage of opinions about what that should look like. Does there need to be some sort of structure or organization to prevent working at cross purposes as we kind of go toward that goal?
I believe there must be some type of concentrated effort to bring those folks together, too. We, coincidentally, about the time this whole grassroots movement started, it seemed like, in our area anyway, a Fiveco region that is one of those community ad groups, they'd also called a meeting to try to network the tourism groups together. So it was the first meeting we'd attended after our What's Next EKY get-together was all about tourism. So I think people are realizing we've got to work together.
Your survey found that people are calling for more employment opportunities. And besides tourism, what other economic development drivers do you think might work in the area?
One thing that Mesa is focusing on is trying to build out certain sectors. And one of those sectors is the creative economy. You know, East Kentucky has a rich history of arts and culture. And the report that the Kentucky Arts Council produced in 2014 showed that more people are self-employed in the creative economy than any other economic sector. And so we feel like there's a lot of potential for entrepreneurship within the creative economy. Lots of people are artists and know how to produce, but need help figuring out how to make a livelihood out of that. We're also focusing on the energy sector with MACID, where there's great opportunities building out energy efficiency and clean energy within this region. The food sector with local food and our partner Community Farm Alliance is doing a lot of work in that area. Mm-hmm. I think tourism, again, is a great potential, but I think there are dangers around tourism as well. It can be exploitive of local cultures and people and places. It can be extractive. You know, people from the outside can come in and own things and kind of take the profit out of the region. But I think there are a lot of opportunities in Eastern Kentucky.
There are some other towns that we haven't mentioned coming to the table that I would think could benefit from joining, places like Sandy Hook or West Liberty, Moorhead, mm-hmm. to name a few. Are you all in communication with those folks?
We started right off the bat a Facebook page, a little social media thing, to try to at least get the word out and connect people. But what we found is there's been so many little small projects, small accomplishments, and those kind of things that just hadn't been shared with others. So we decided to start sharing them with each other, and that network is also growing on social media. And then anything beyond all the press we are getting and information that people are getting out there, it just seems like the word is beginning to be spread. So,
yeah, we're very much in the incubation stage. And so we have relationships with people in a lot of communities, and we're in the midst of figuring out how do we help those communities connect and form a network. And so we're really thinking about this as a marathon rather than a sprint. This is long-term work. Building a network takes many, many years. And what we want to do is make the network valuable to people. We don't want to create meetings for people to come to just to come to a meeting.
Well, I'm a musician, and I can't help myself. When I'm talking about things, sometimes they turn into songs in my mind. And right now, the one that's playing on a loop is, do you remember Lonnie Mack, the great legendary Cincinnati guitar player?
He was
something else. He had a song that we used to try to copy a long time ago, Where There's a Will, There's a Way. That seems to be a theme song going on here, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I do. And it, I believe that definitely the will and the heart of the people are there. So I just believe we're starting to see it happen.
Well, if somebody from a community that we haven't mentioned here or hasn't stepped up to the plate yet hears this and they'd like to get in touch and learn more, who should they contact and how?
Well, we have a Facebook page, as Dan mentioned. We have a Facebook page and a Facebook group, What's Next EKY. We also have a website, which is whatsnexteky.org, and there are ways to connect on all of those places.
Betsy Whaley is Executive Vice President of MACED, the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, based in Berea. And she has been with us along with Dan Click, Director and Gallery Coordinator of the Grayson Gallery and Arts Center. And thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Back in a moment with Richmond Police Detective Stuart Adams on the domestic violence happening around us and how it begins.
Controlling behavior starts it out.
And Jennifer Lanehart, director of Hope's Wings, the Madison County Shelter for Victims of Domestic Abuse.
And I would echo what Stuart said, that control is a big deal.
Later in the hour...
What I'm seeing is that, yes, the economy is proving for a particular segment of individuals, but for a lot of Kentuckians, it is not.
Mary Shearer of Kentucky Habitat for Humanity, here along with Lexington Habitat's Rachel Childress on a just-launched national campaign to improve housing affordability for 10 million Americans in the next 5 years.
We talk about a decent place to live until all of us do, none of us do. And what that means is for folks who live in stable housing, it's quality, it's affordable, children do better in school, more people go to college, they make more money, they're more active in the community, they're more likely to vote, they're more likely to give back and volunteer. That's what we want for everyone.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Kentucky ranks 9th in the nation for its rate of women murdered by men. Studies indicate that victims of domestic violence face the greatest threat from spouses or intimate partners who are armed with guns. Kentucky's domestic violence programs receive over 30,000 calls per year for shelter, housing, and other advocacy assistance. In 2018, there were 27 people killed by domestic violence in Kentucky, and an additional 12 who were killed because they were an acquaintance of the victim and happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. That's a sketch of the Kentucky story of domestic violence, but what does it look like closer to home? Here with us to talk about that are Jennifer Lanehart, director of Hope's Wings, the Madison County Shelter for Victims of Domestic Abuse, and Richmond Police Detective Stuart Adams, who's been working in this field for almost 30 years. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
So, Jennifer, let's begin with you and you telling us about Hope's Wings. What does Hope's Wings do?
Well, Hope's Wings is the domestic violence program here in Madison County, and we offer lots of different services. First and foremost, an emergency shelter for women and children who are fleeing abusive homes. You know, while they're at the shelter, they receive different services such as counseling, support groups, educational groups, and that type of thing. But we also provide housing services for victims of domestic violence. We work with our community partners, such as law enforcement and prosecution, to coordinate a response to the crime of domestic violence in Madison County. And we do different advocacy services. So I think we wear lots of different hats.
What brought you to this work?
Gosh, that could be a long story in itself, but ultimately, I did a senior practicum, social work practicum in 2009. It just happened to be at Hope's Wings, and as I did that practicum, I found myself really drawn to that population of people because there's all kinds of hurting people, and domestic violence is messy a little bit, but the people are... I don't know. They're searching for something, and just I'm drawn to helping them find a different way.
So Jennifer and Detective Adams, this is a question for each of you. You may each want to answer this, but what sorts of behaviors constitute domestic abuse?
Controlling behavior starts it out. We have a what we call a power wheel, and we look at the power wheel to see the different types of control, financial, that's a big one, religion, a lot of it. But mostly, as law enforcement, we're looking at the physical stuff, most or the sexual stuff, but it's any type of physical hitting, strangulation, anything like that.
And I would kind of echo what Stuart said. That control is a big deal. Lots of people get angry, but they don't batter people. They don't verbally and emotionally abuse people when they get angry. So control is key. But also, we kind of look at generational things. You know, children who are raised in homes where domestic violence occurs are more likely to become batterers or victims themselves. So we want to kind of break that cycle. And that's something that we try to work really hard on at Hope's Wings when children come into the shelter. We want to make sure that they know that doesn't have to continue for them. That doesn't have to be their lives as well.
Continuing the thought about control, I looked on the Center for Disease Control site and saw a figure that 85% of victims of domestic violence will return to abusers because they can't financially sustain themselves or their children. And for survivors to escape and recover from abusive relationships, they need more than just a place to go. They need that financial empowerment. Do you help them with that in your programming?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, when the shelter opened in 2009, we focused a lot on immediate safety. So we housed almost 206 women and children in that first year, and we were focused just on that crisis intervention piece. In 2012, we reevaluated our program and asked ourselves, why are people returning to their abusers? What would prevent them from coming to Hope's Wings to get services? Asked ourselves all kinds of questions like that. And what we found was the same statistic that you found when we did exit evaluations with people leaving. The statistic that you found was number one here as well. It was the largest reason that women were leaving our shelter and going back to their abusers. So what we wanted to do in 2012 was change up our program a little bit. So we became a three-phase program at that time. Phase one being those safety needs, meeting those crisis intervention services, offering safe shelter, filing emergency protection orders, getting medical assistance if that's what was needed. But, you know, just addressing the safety concerns of the victim. If they decided to stay with us and work the three phases, they would graduate into phase two. Phase two is where our serious work is done at Hope's Wings, actually, because we want to focus on that sustainability piece. We ask the ladies, hey, what do you want to do? Sometimes they've never been asked that before. You would be amazed at the women who've come through who haven't really gotten an opportunity to work a lot. Some who have not been able to finish even their high school education, and they want to. And so we ask them, what do you want to do? How do you see yourself being successful and sustainable? And they get to choose their path. And then it's our job to help them meet those goals. So in phase two of our program, we're offering them counseling services and support groups and education groups, but we also will be we also focus on job preparedness, working with them to get their high school GEDs. That's a key focus in phase two, and that can take a couple months or it might take a year for somebody to prepare themselves for work.
That must be a mighty liberating experience to come out from under an abusive situation and be asked, what do you want to do? What's important to you?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, the faces of some of the ladies, like when you ask them that, at first they're kind of like, I don't know. Like, what do you think I should do? And that's not what we do at Hope Swings. We don't tell people what they should do. Sometimes I want to, but that's not productive. We don't do that. We say, well, what do you want? What do you think you can be successful at? And then we help them meet those goals because they're certainly capable of doing it if they've got somebody behind them that believes in them and it can lead them in the direction that they want to go.
Okay. And turning again to Detective Stuart Adams from the Richmond Police Department, from a police perspective, what's the situation in Richmond? How does Richmond compare? Are you seeing an increase or are we status quo? What's it like?
I think we're seeing an increase. I started with Richmond Police Department in 2012 specifically to work with Hope Swings, domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking cases. We keep stats every month. I see every case of domestic violence from Richmond Police Department across my desk. When we first started, of course, the reporting, a lot has changed in those 7 years. We were getting reports from 2, 3, 5 or something, maybe a week. It's a daily occurrence now for the police. And I'm sure this is agencies across not only the state, but the nation, but for sure in this county, it's a daily occurrence multiple times a day. On my way over here today, as I was telling you earlier, we got toned out, which is an emergency tone that we have on a radio for domestic. Hmm. So it's our stats have gone way up.
Any idea what's driving that increase?
You know, it's hard to say. Substance abuse is always going to be an issue with that. Alcohol and other substances is always going to be a major factor for domestics.
How do you screen to be certain that somebody who alleges abuse or denies being an abuser is being truthful?
Well, for us, I mean, you do the best you can. You know, we have an assessment tool. When somebody calls us for services, they're claiming to be domestic violence victims. So what we do is we use our assessment tool to just kind of talk with them, you know, ask them questions and receive their answers. But we have a conversation, you know. And really all that we ever have to go on is what somebody tells us. And we typically err on the side of caution and, you know, take their claims seriously.
And how about you, Detective Adams?
Law enforcement is a lot like the shelter. It's called a good investigation. You ask a lot of questions. You're looking for evidence. A lot of these are cut and dry. You can see the injuries or the wounds. Sometimes it takes a little bit more dwelling into what led up to that or what's caused this incident. And we try to look at the totality of everything now instead of just the isolated incident. So.
And I know you use something called a blueprint for safety. What is that?
Actually, the blueprint for safety is quite the feat for Madison County because it's a national model that was actually developed in Minnesota for addressing the crime of domestic violence in a community. So often domestic violence can just go on as an everyday call or whatever, but we're really starting to focus on it here in Madison County as a pretty significant crime. And so with the Blueprint for Safety, when we got that grant several years ago, we spent years getting partners on board. And the partners would include all of our criminal legal justice system here in Madison County, from 911 to all of our law enforcement agencies, to the jail, to pretrial services, the prosecutors in both offices, and probation and parole. So we all have a team. So we will meet quarterly, typically, and we kind of talk about our policies. Like, do they mesh together? So the Blueprint for Safety is kind of like one coordinated community domestic violence policy where we have learned to share information better, to collect information better, and to present that to prosecution and to judges better so crimes can be addressed appropriately. You know, we're the only community in Kentucky that has implemented this policy and this program. And so we're pretty proud of the fact that we've got people who are so willing to work together.
I guess it's safe to say that domestic abuse knows no socioeconomic boundaries. And we hear of cases of domestic abuse that involve prominent members of communities as perpetrators, as victims. Does an abuser's stature in the community discourage a victim, whether it's somebody they've abused or they themselves are the abused? Does it discourage them from coming forward because they're worried about reputation and that kind of thing?
I would say so.
It does. It does. It's actually harder to work with a victim that, you know, and I'm doing quotation marks when I say prominent, but it's harder to work with that victim. And frankly, we got a case going on right now that our perpetrator thinks that he's a prominent member of our community. And it scares the victim a little bit more because that subject probably apt to know more people or maybe even people in the judicial system, the legal system, and that scares the victim. Mm-hmm. They think they've got the upper hand on and frankly, they'll use that against the victim too.
Uh-huh. What do you advise people to do if they find out that a friend is going through this, a colleague is going through this? What should they do to help a victim of domestic violence?
I would suggest that friend do some research and find a program, a domestic violence program, local to their community, and encourage that person to reach out to that agency. It's not the safest thing in the world to just advise somebody to leave. That's the most dangerous time for a victim, actually. So I would always just encourage people to know your resources in your community.
I will say, too, it's easy for somebody just to say, well, call the police. You need to call the police. That's not always the best answer. I'll be the first to admit that sometimes our intervention is the worst thing that a victim could do. That could put them in a very dangerous situation. So they do need to. Now, we probably will need to get involved at some point.
Is that because it kind of escalates the situation?
Yes, very much so a lot of times. And frankly, a lot of times victims don't want something legally to happen to their perpetrator. Mm-hmm. That goes back to the control things. Mm-hmm. They love them and they don't want them in trouble. They just want the domestic violence to stop. So I would say to try to reach out to some sort of program like Hope's Wings.
Is there a particular responsive helpline in our area that you recommend people keep in mind?
Mm-hmm. Yep, the number for Hope Swings. And that number is 859-623-4095.
And Jennifer, I know that Hope Swings is not a member of the Kentucky Coalition Against Domestic Violence, correct?
That's correct.
So that has an impact on your ability to raise funds?
Well, we can raise funds, and trust me, we do. It has an impact on the level of services that we can offer. And I shouldn't say level, that's probably not the right word, but the amount of services that we can offer. Our resources are a bit more limited. However, we still write lots of grants, and we do lots of fundraising in our community. And I'll be honest, our community has to be the best. When Hope Swings began, it was because our community saw a need for the services.
We're certainly hearing an increasing need from Detective Adams.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And with that being said, our community also steps up to make sure that we have what we need at the shelter, whether it's monetary donations, participating in our fundraising events, or just, you know, bringing paper towel and laundry detergents and, you know, those consumables that we go through when there's a house full of women and children. So you know, we are very fortunate. We just work really hard.
Well, I would say the community is very fortunate to have people like you doing this. This is a challenging, very tough work. You are facing up against the forces of cruelty and meanness on a daily basis, and you work with people who are experiencing heartbreak, fear, anxiety, desperation, physical injury. And I'm assuming that you have to empathize to some extent. How do you protect yourselves? How do you prevent the work from taking a personal toll on you?
Well, I'll say for me, as a social worker, you know, when you go to school, they drill, you know, self-care into your head, that you should always practice self-care, because if you are in a terrible position, then you're in no position to help someone else. So for me, my self-care is reading fiction books. I love Happily Ever After stories, and I love to fish. My husband likes to fish, and there's nothing like being outside when you can.
Detective Adams?
Well, I lean a lot on my faith, and I've done that for my 30 years of law enforcement, but I also have what I call tree stand therapy. I'm a big outdoorsman, hunting, mm-hmm. fishing, camping, and my time to relax and just is in a deer stand. I watch nature. A lot of times my bow or gun is just hanging there, and I'm just reflecting on everything around me, just enjoy being away from the stuff.
Well, Jennifer Lanehart, director of Hope's Wings, the Madison County Shelter for Victims of Domestic Violence, and Richmond Police Detective Stuart Adams, thank you both for stopping by Eastern Standard. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having us.
Coming up after a short break, they say it's a strong economy, so why are so many people struggling to keep a roof over their heads? NPR's Pam Fessler with the national picture, Mary Shearer and Rachel Childress with how housing affordability looks across the state and here in central Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or on the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
The economy right now is strong, but wages aren't keeping pace. And as NPR's Pam Fessler reports, that means more middle-class families across the country are struggling to find homes at prices and rents they can afford.
A.J. Jackson takes me up a path between some brick garden apartments in Silver Spring, Maryland, right outside Washington, D.C. Tall oak trees shade the property. Lush purple and blue hydrangea line the walks.
This is a sort of beautiful park-like setting. We've got a stream valley running through it, yet we're walking distance to the metro station. We're walking distance to downtown Silver Spring, which has arts, entertainment, grocery, and retail services, Whole Foods. We're on major bus lines.
And the rent is surprisingly reasonable for this area. $1,300 a month for a one-bedroom. Affordable for a middle-income worker.
Making somewhere between $60,000 and $80,000-$90,000 a year. It's a rent that they can afford to pay and still have money, you know, for groceries, for health care, for transportation, for other necessities.
Jackson runs an initiative by a local developer, JBG Smith, working with a nonprofit and private investors. They're trying to preserve affordable housing for teachers, construction workers, IT support staff, and others who help the local economy thrive, but who are increasingly being squeezed out of the rental market.
for those households, even though the economy is improving, even though affordability generally is improving, it's been getting worse year by year.
Chris Herbert is managing director of Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies, which is out with its annual report on the state of the nation's housing. Herbert says despite some improvement, nearly half of all renters have to pay more than 30% of their incomes on housing. He says new apartments are being built, but mostly for high-end renters, especially in areas with the strongest economies.
So if you're living in San Francisco, in a city with however many billionaires that have been identified, you know, the people at the upper end of the income distribution help to bid up the cost of land for everybody.
The pain is also being felt in poorer cities. Regina Clark is an anti-poverty activist from Memphis, Tennessee, who was in Washington, D.C. last week for a conference. She says investors are coming into her city, buying up homes and remodeling them.
And they're making the housing even more expensive. The average homeowner can barely afford about $400 or $500 a month in a rent or a mortgage, and they're now bringing out rent that's about $1,500 to $1,600.
Forcing out many longtime residents. The Harvard study finds that overall, the nation is losing apartments that rent for less than $800 a month at a rapid pace, about 1 million a year, which means people have to either spend more of their incomes on rent, double up with family and friends, or become homeless. Herbert says on the positive side, there's more interest in trying to fix the problem now that it's hitting the middle class. A.J. Jackson hopes his company's initiative will help. He shows me one of their recently renovated units, which has new but modest kitchen appliances. He says the pressure in the market is to make these places more upscale.
Yeah, you could come in with granite countertops and high-end appliance packages.
But he says that would mean a much higher rent and another working-class family struggling to pay. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
So what does the housing affordability picture look like in Kentucky? In June, Kentucky Habitat for Humanity joined habitat organizations all across the country in the launch of the Habitat's first national advocacy campaign. They call it Cost of Home, and the goal is to improve home affordability for 10 million people in the U.S. over the next 5 years. Here with us are Mary Shearer, Executive Director of Kentucky Habitat for Humanity, and Rachel Childress, CEO of Lexington Habitat for Humanity. Mary and Rachel, thanks so much for stopping by Eastern Standard.
Thanks for having us. We're grateful to be here.
Yes, it's great.
And first, Mary, for clarity's sake, as we have this discussion, we probably should draw a distinction between housing affordability versus affordable housing. Can you do that for us?
Well, I can. We use both the terms, but I would say in the last several years, Habitat for Humanity as a global organization uses housing affordability more. When you talk about affordable housing, Tom, usually it's talking about housing units for individuals who earn below an area median income. But that's not always the right thing to think about. In housing affordability, what we're looking at is for a family or individual to pay no more than 30% of their income per month on housing costs. And that's across the board, whether it is a person who earns 80%, 115%, or even 30% and below of an area median income.
Okay, I thought that was an important distinction to make. So, in an op-ed published in the Courier Journal recently, you express alarm about housing affordability in Kentucky. And I'd like to ask each of you what you're seeing. Let's start with you, Mary.
What I'm seeing is that, yes, the economy is improving for a particular segment of individuals, but for a lot of Kentuckians, it is not. Our elderly, our special needs, our extremely low to low-income Kentuckians are still suffering because of a lack of simple, decent, affordable homes that they can afford based upon what they earn.
Rachel, Lexington is thought of as a relatively affluent community in the general scheme of things. In light of that, what are you seeing in the area of affordability here?
Well, we have close to 16,000 households in Lexington who would fall in that category of below 60% area median income. Right now, we think there are about 9,000 affordable units. About 4,000 of those in rental are expected to come off that market in the next 5 years, which would leave a huge 6,000 to 10,000 unit deficit. But when Mary talks about decent affordable, one of the things we have to think about is affordability is not the only issue. So if it's not quality or functioning, you know, if you have a roof leak, if you can't afford your utilities, if your children don't have a safe place to play or a quiet place to study, then whether or not you can afford it is not the only factor you have to consider.
You mentioned 4,000 units coming off the market. What's going on there?
Well, these are units that were subsidized through some type of program who had an affordability period, it's called in the grant world. So that restriction, those restrictions are expiring. So one of the things our Affordable Housing Fund locally is trying to do is reinvest in those units so that they stay affordable and stay in that market.
Okay, our audience is spread across central and eastern Kentucky. What does the picture look like for the Appalachian region?
Well, first of all, there is not enough affordable housing units in eastern Kentucky or even central Kentucky. In eastern Kentucky, there is a real lack of rental units. And Habitat really supports rental individuals who want to rent. Not everybody is cut out from home ownership. And I would say, with a Kentucky Housing Corporation, our state housing finance agency study, now this is a number of years ago, but here just in the next few years, it could be up to 50,000 affordable rental units will lose their affordability status because of the subsidies and those coming to an end that Rachel just spoke about.
Okay, then that brings us right around to the National Cost of Home campaign that just got underway. And I understand that this is aimed at promoting policy and systems change in four key areas. And I have that list. And if you will, I'd like to look at each of them one at a time. At the top of the list is supply and preservation of affordable homes, which I think goes to what you were just talking about.
Oh, absolutely. And I believe now Habitat has a real focus on keeping individuals in their homes, and that is through critical home repairs. Of course, we will always, Tom, be a first and foremost, mainly first-time home ownership program. But with that, we still do a lot of owner-occupied rehabs to make energy-efficient upgrades to homes so that families can age gracefully and affordably and sustainably in their homes. And this is what they want to do. So we need policy change. Tom, we need more funding in Kentucky to fund these particular efforts that affordable housing entities, as well as some of those entities that you spoke about that utilize tax credits very, very successfully. But we all need to work together to make policy changes so that we can create more funding for affordable housing.
The other three key areas would seem to go to how this gets done. And either of you can respond to access to credit.
Mostly, I would say, the families and individuals that we serve. Habitat serves 60% and below the area median income. But for instance, when we get into eastern Kentucky and those counties in the east and southeast of our state, we're looking at 30% and below. And there's no way they can walk into a traditional lending facility and take out a traditional loan that I could, or Rachel, or even you, Tom. So they need access to some financial products that serve them.
And not just access to these predatory lenders who will gladly do the paycheck cash out and ultimately end up paying thousands of times as much owed back. So credit that is affordable. There are a number of homeownership low-income credit products that have access in Lexington for families, but eastern Kentucky, but in Lexington too, anywhere you drive around, you're going to see these payday lending kind of places that are are a prey on our low-income family.
The next area is land use.
Huge challenge. Still a huge challenge in Kentucky, but for habitats that service families on the East and West Coast, it is just out of this world as far as the prices they are paying for usable land. One of the things that I learned early on when I took this job with Kentucky Habitat for Humanity is that not all land is good land. You've got to look at it and how much infrastructure are you needing to put in. Many of our affiliates now are paying too high a price for the land, but we also, Tom, have a situation where those lots might be located and where our families realistically want to live. We've got the NIMBY and the YIMBY syndromes. Not in my backyard.
Okay.
And you're in my backyard. So what are we going to do about it, and how are we going to live together?
It's the first time I've heard YIMBY. And that's pretty concerning.
Yes, it is.
Give us an example of that, if you would.
Well, I will tell you. After the 2012 tornadoes in West Liberty, Kentucky, we had a small one-county affiliate there that branched out into a tri-county, Rowan County, Morgan, and Menifee counties. There was such prejudice even there of where this affiliate wanted to build for families trying to recover from complete loss and devastation of everything in their lives. And going back to, you know, the credit, there were many people that wanted to sell some lots to our small, basically one staff Habitat affiliate for upwards of $25,000-$30,000 for a small lot. I mean, we've got to work together. Affordable housing and housing affordability, it still has a stigma. I mean, Rachel, I think you might think this as well. When you mention that, people think of a substandard, you know, not great quality home that is going to be built. Is it energy efficiency? Absolutely, it is energy efficiency. We pride ourselves on that at Habitat now because we know that not only is it a question of an affordable mortgage, but also the sustainability of a family to remain in that home over the long term that can afford the utilities and the maintenance and the upkeep.
Are there enough willing developers out there who have the expertise to harness things like low-income housing tax credits, LIHTC, it's referred to, and convert them into quality affordable housing? I understand it's very technical, massively layered, so many who could otherwise do it stay away, which means there are fewer players in the field than what's needed to meet demand or even come close to it. Thoughts on that?
There are some who are willing to do it. We have a couple of ones based in Lexington who are quite good at it, very willing to do it. But you're right. There are developers who do not want to get caught up in the red tape. They don't want the bureaucracy. They don't want someone looking over their shoulders. They want to function as they do. And some of those folks do housing which is affordable for moderate to low income families without those. But I'm not sure I would ever say there's enough because we have these huge deficits and the huge need, but there are some who are willing to do it and do a great job.
There's an affordable housing caucus in the state legislature. We've grown accustomed, I'm afraid, to sharp, polarizing political division in this state, in this country. Yet this caucus is described as bipartisan, is it?
Yes, it is. And the leadership is, we did a Have a Heart for Housing Day last February 14th at our Capitol. We had a legislative breakfast. We had a rally. We had individual affiliates go visit with their elected officials to talk about, first of all, to say, thank you for what you have done up to this point. And this is what we have done. This is how we have responded. But we need to do so much more. So, yes, we got signed on about 15 of our legislators. We have co-chairs of the caucus that are both from the Senate and the House, Republican and Democratic, respectively. We're very excited about this, and we are reaching out right now at this point to get them together and planning an event to bring them together before the end of the summer.
And do you get the idea that they sense the urgency that you've expressed?
I get the idea that they realize something needs to be done, but I think it's our job. We need to do more informing about what these challenges are, and we need to make sure that they really, really understand. I'm not sure there's going to be anybody as passionate as Rachel and I are as far as the need and how it is important that if one of us succeeds here in Kentucky, all of us can succeed and bring our commonwealth to the point of where it needs to be for everyone, with a fulfilled, vibrant life in their home that is affordable, whether it's a rental unit or they own their home for the first time.
Okay, we have just a little bit of time left, but I wanted to make sure that we brought this around to what this really is all about. And maybe each of you can comment on this. And that's what having a decent, affordable, functioning place to call home means to a family.
Well, our vision is that everyone has a decent place to live. And that means more than the structure to which we return. It means the street. It means the neighborhood. It means the community as a whole. So when we talk about a decent place to live, until all of us do, none of us do. And what that means is for folks who live in stable housing, it's quality, it's affordable, children do better in school, more people go to college, they make more money, they're more active in the community, they're more likely to vote, they're more likely to give back and volunteer. That's what we want for everyone, is to love their neighbors. Our repair program in Lexington we call Love Your Neighborhood, because we are not only loving them, we're providing others the opportunity to love their neighbors. And I think that's what it all boils down to, is let's all live together in peace and harmony successfully.
Mary, do you want to add anything to that?
I'm not sure I could, except for me, I will just put this out, that a home is the foundation for everything that will be successful for a child, a mother, a father, their brothers and sisters, the community, the city, our state.
Mary Shearer, Executive Director of Kentucky Habitat for Humanity, and Rachel Childress, CEO of Lexington Habitat for Humanity. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Hold on to me as we go, as we roll down this unfamiliar road. And although this wave is stringing us along, just know you're not alone, 'cause I'm gonna make this place your home.
Next week on Eastern Standard, the big regional mental health organization, Bluegrass.org, has a new name. What is it and what does it mean? We'll hear from Chief Clinical Officer Don Rogers. We have a conversation about Kentucky's overwhelmed foster care system with Chris Peck of Hope Hill Youth Services in Mount Sterling. And then to Corbin and Dylan Frost, a partner in Ascension Consulting, a Kentucky tech startup that is billing in the millions. Also, WEKU's Mary Meehan reports on pain management alternatives to opioids. And some whitewater rafting and kayaking tips from our great outdoors guru, Chris Begley. And that wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app, as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, and online at weku.fm. And we'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu or call and leave voicemail at 859-622-WEKU. That's 622-9358. We might include your thoughts in a forthcoming edition. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.